For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM. Good afternoon. This is Zain with the Shai Rana Show. And today, of course, we're entering a new era, which is Trump 2.0, as somebody had said, mentioned it or framed it recently. Of course, we have already, as some of you might have heard, we have the ceasefire that's supposed to have started last Sunday in Gaza, and that ceasefire was basically pushed forward by an emissary sent by the Trump administration, who forced them to the table, who forced the Israelis to the table. Even on the Sabbath, he had said that you have to come and you have to, and don't screw this up. He used the stronger language, but so basically, what we saw is what we knew the whole time, is that a U.S. president, even one that hasn't taken the presidency yet, can actually stop this barbaric act of genocide with one phone call or with one emissary. Of course, Biden, we know now that Biden, if you didn't know before, that Biden and Kamala and Blinken and all the rest of the press corps for the White House have been lying about them ceaselessly trying to stop the war. And on top of everything, of course, we have people right now so obsessed with the fact that they're discovering that the oligarch that are running this country have fascistic tendencies, like the salute that Elon Musk made a few days ago. It's really interesting that we have people who weren't really complaining at all or weren't commenting about the real fascism of the Biden administration. You see, fascism is when you destroy and try to eliminate a group of people, in this case, the Palestinians, which Biden tried to do. This is not what happened. This genocide, it is Biden's genocide. It is an American war. It is America who killed over 20,000 children, maimed over 5,000 children. It is America who has killed over 100,000 Palestinians, and the count keeps increasing because they're removing people from under the rubble. And we will see more of this as reporters are allowed inside Gaza. At the same time, even Blinken had to admit that the Palestinian resistance has replenished all the fighters they had that have been killed, and they are still standing. They are still armed, and they're still ready to defend Palestine. And we are at a moment where the whole world, if you believe that the reputation of the United States government or Israel or the British government or even the Canadian government is intact after all of this, you are living in a bubble, because the global majority, and that includes the global South, but it includes huge numbers of Americans, huge numbers of British citizens, huge numbers of people, even in the West, have seen that international law does not apply to Israel, does not apply to the United States, and it's the United States is that is blocking the application of the international law. So you can shout and scream about the Nazi salute, and say that he's a fascist. I don't care. I don't have much love for Elon Musk. I don't have any love for any billionaire CEO that's running the country right now. I've never had it or never, but really acknowledge also that what Biden did was fascism. It was active fascism, the killing of innocent civilians, and especially when he was at the same time confessing to the fact that he knew. He revealed a conversation recently on mainstream media that he had with Netanyahu, trying to blame Netanyahu for all of this and not take any blame for it. All the while, he had approved in his last month in office the $8 billion to go to Israel. And now, as people and as the press is going through Gaza and seeing all the American-made fragments that have been embedded in the heads of children, in the stomachs of pregnant women, and all over the Palestinian men, and the killing that's happening in Jenin right now, it's all American weaponry. And so there's our work is cut out for us in the next 4 years for one, confronting the prison industrial complex. And by the way, the boycott and divestment movement, I want you to pay attention to their coming announcements, because boycott and divestment is more important than ever right now. And this there's going to be a national day of action against Cisco, which provides a lot of the technology for this genocide. And that'll be on February 11th. So look out for announcements, because this is a call for global action, and the details of what's going to happen in DC are still forthcoming. Just a few announcements before I go to our clip today. For one, these are a couple of personal announcements. Tonight I'll be reading from my short collection, a collection of short stories, Is This How You Eat a Watermelon, at the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, which is hosted by the beautiful and worker-owned, rather independent bookstore, Lost City Books in Adams Morgan. I'll be reading at the Line Hotel. Don't try to RSVP because it'll say sold out, but there's 350 seats there, and I'm sure many people will not show up, because at free events you're almost guaranteed that people will not show up because they don't have much of a commitment if they don't have paid tickets. And lastly, I'm also doing every Wednesday, starting next Wednesday, a workshop on writing with whimsy for people that come, especially from troubled areas, or or reporting on that, and what meaning war-torn areas. But it's not just that, it's just about how important is whimsy in writing. This is one of many workshops that I'll be offering, and that's going to be conducted. If you're interested in this writing workshop, you can go to Bowl Co-op, which is the only worker-owned bookstore in DC. Bowl Co-op, BOL Co-op, to their website, and sign up for the writing workshop. And with that, also, I wanted to introduce our segment of the day, which comes from the Electronic Intifada. And in here, Nora Barrows and Ali Abu Nima and others basically talk about what propelled, why is it that it ended up to be Trump that actually called or pressured Israel for a ceasefire, and what is he asking for in return, and what favors is he gonna give in return. And this is a brilliant analysis, as we've had all for the last 15 months from Electronic Intifada. So let's have a listen.
Start with what the goals of the Israelis were for this war. Number one, the war, the violence, the genocide was supposedly to put pressure on Qassam to surrender and turn over the prisoners. So return the captives failed. Destroy Qassam, that was goal number two. Clearly failed, spectacularly failed. Even Blinken said the other day, speaking before the Atlantic Council, that American intelligence says that Qassam is bigger today than they were before the war. And I think that that's an obvious statement when you kill people's families in the way that that they've done, and people have watched and want to be a part of resistance. They want to be a part of the liberation. I have no doubt that they're larger than they, even by the inflated numbers that the Israelis give, they're larger. So number two was to destroy Qassam. Number three was to destroy the Hamas government. That failed as well. There's still administration in the Gaza Strip. The government of Hamas is able to negotiate for a prisoner exchange. They're able to manage the environment in Gaza. The healthcare system has been reestablished. The education system is resisting. The civil defense operated throughout the war, so failure on that. And number four, that Gaza is no longer a threat to Israel. Gaza now has 70,000 tons of explosives dropped on them with a 5% dud rate. They have explosive munitions for two generations of war against the Israelis, and they have a population that is enraged and believes that they can win wars. They believe they can blow through the border, attack Israeli military bases, withstand the genocide that the rich Western world backed against their tiny enclave, and they came out the other side. So, failure on all the Israeli goals of the war. The conditions of the ceasefire that Yahya Sinwar set at the beginning, the conditions never changed. Number one, end of the aggression. Not phases where the war goes and you get prisoners back and then you go back to war. No, an end to the aggression. That was the deal had to include end to the aggression, withdraw from the corridors, Philadelphia corridor, Netzarim corridor. That's number two. That must happen. Number three, a return of all Palestinians to the north. The Palestinians must be returned to the north. They're not being trapped in camps in the south. Even though that's the primary goal of Israel, Qassam, Hamas refused that. People will be allowed to return to the north, that there would be a prisoner exchange, and number five, reconstruction and an end to the siege. Because the end of the siege is part of the ceasefire. As Yahya Sinwar said, the siege is warfare. You don't continue. The ceasefire agreement has to lift the siege because the siege is war. So there's no ceasefire with a siege. And that is Sinwar's principles. And those are the principles that were agreed to. As Maureen accurately reported at the Electronic Intifada in her article, we haven't seen the final printed deal. It's still being, it hasn't been finalized. They're still talking over points. But we know, and even Biden said yesterday, that it's word for word the same as the May 27th agreement. And we know a lot from that agreement. It is that all four of Qassam's principles, all four of Yahya Sinwar's principles are true. End of the aggression, phase one deals into phase two, deals into phase three, but all of them are built together and they all are premised upon an end to the aggression. Israel cannot go back to war and get their second, that get their soldiers back in the second stage. So stage one of the deal is the essentially the humanitarian aspect of the November 2023 exchange, that Israel didn't give Qassam time to find the other prisoners. So these are the 33 prisoners that are in the humanitarian exchange. At the time, Qassam was giving them for 3-1, three Palestinian prisoners for one Israeli prisoner. Now, because Abu Ubaidah said right from the start that if you go back to war, the price for these prisoners will never go down. It will only go up, and it did. So in the first stage of the deal, these will happen out over each individual release, one per day. And on the Israeli side, there's 33 Israeli captives that will be released. And on the Palestinian side, 2,000 prisoners. That includes the bulk of that 2,000 is the people captured in Gaza, who were never charged, didn't have anything to do with anything. They were marched in their underwear out of shelters where they were with their families. They didn't have anything to do with anything. And Israel took them and took them to brutal torture camps. Those people will be released. They were used as bargaining chips. Withdraw from the Philadelphia corridor in phases. Withdraw from the Netzarim corridor in phases. The first phase in the first week is to move off the coastal road, Al-Rashid, the coastal highway. That will allow Palestinians to move north on foot. So that is a key part of this deal. The other part of the deal is 10 hours of no overflight of Israeli drones, and no overflight for 12 hours a day during the exchange. That's critical so that Qassam can find the prisoners without giving up their positions and have Israel renege on the ceasefire and massacre them. So that's necessary to get Israelis out. And then, of course, as Nora reported, the surge of humanitarian aid is supposed to be 600 trucks a day, 50 fuel trucks, half of them to northern Gaza every single day. And that's surge. And then there's some small details like 200,000 tents. That's because this deal was done in April and March and finalized in May. So 200,000 tents were necessary at that time. But 9 months of genocide, that number is going to need to go up considerably. It's 60,000 mobile homes. And the immediate rehabilitation of electricity, health clinics, hospitals, and bakeries. So that's all going to happen immediately in stage one. Stage one is 42 days, but it can be extended because at the end of stage one is the negotiation for stage two. Stage two is when the soldiers are released. And that is where there is still back and forth about the names of people to be released. So the stage one of the deal is 33 Israeli captives for 2,000 Palestinian prisoners, 250 of them with life sentences. And just to note, Sinwar said that these people could go back on October 8th. If Israel wanted, they could have taken all of these humanitarian people in the humanitarian release. They could have taken them all back on October 8th. They could have done that, and they didn't. They could have taken them all in November if they had have extended the November pause for a week and allowed Qassam to find those people. They didn't do that. And as a result, many died. Many were killed by the Israelis. But now the exchange, instead of 3-for-1, it's thousands, and it's 250 prisoners with life sentences. So core cadre of the resistance who have been in prison, and Israel expected prison to be their grave, like Yahya Sinwar, who was released in the Shalit deal, are going to come back to Gaza. And that's a significant accomplishment of the resistance as well. So those are the main deal as far as we know it. There's a Hebrew version, an Arabic version, and an English version that all match on the May 27th agreement. And it's the basis of the agreement that went to the UN, was it the Security Council? I think it might have been the Security Council.
The one that the U.S. kept vetoing, Linda Thomas Greenfield, her legacy.
But then ultimately there was one that Biden accepted, and that's the one where he had the ice cream cone and microphone, and he thought there was going to be a deal. So this is just really, it's grotesque that this deal was done last year and that Israelis carried on with 9 more months of genocide. And in the end, they have less of their people to bring home. So it's clear that the goal was genocide, not bringing their people home.
Yeah, of course, as it's always been.
And, you know, a big aspect of this is, and I'm going to talk more about Donald Trump's involvement, but this is confusing a lot of people, and they're saying, well, we can't trust this. It's a ruse. Why would Donald Trump insist on this? And I get why people say that, but you have to always look at fundamentals, which is Israel threw everything it had at Gaza, not just everything Israel had, everything the United States had, and they failed to break the resistance. And not only did they fail to break the resistance, but look at the Israeli press today talking about how the army is broken. There's a big story in Haaretz today by Dalia Scheindlin about how the levels of mental trauma, absenteeism, family breakdown among the reservists, people just don't want to come back. The army is broken. And Abu Ubaida told them this would happen right at the beginning. He told them, this is what's going to happen to you. You're either going to be killed or you're going to go back with lifelong physical disabilities or mental disabilities. And it all played out like Abu Ubaida said, so they couldn't keep going. And then you take all the economic and social aspects that we touched on in our discussion with Shir Hever earlier on. And I've heard in the past few days people giving me all these, it's a ruse and they're going to go back to the war after phase one, and it's all a stitch up between Donald Trump and Netanyahu. And this sort of talk frustrates me, I have to say, because we are robbing the resistance and the people of Gaza of their achievement. And they did come through this, and they came through this at a very high price. And the particularly the children, who are going to need a great deal of care, of psychosocial support, they're going to have tremendous trauma. But the Palestinian society in Gaza did and will come through this. But to really get a sense of the scale of Israel's failure, read the Israeli press, because they are saying it. And just one example, and this is not the only one, is this article in Haaretz today, which is headlined, "How Trump Scared Netanyahu into Accepting a Ceasefire Deal with Hamas." And this is by Amos Harel, who is one of their hard-nosed military guys. He's not a leftist. He's not Gideon Levy. And what he says in this article is that after the war, I'm just going to read a few bits. It's a long article. Hamas is in a better position to take control of civilian affairs in Gaza and gradually rebuild its military strength. So there, confirmation from a hard-nosed Israeli military intelligence type correspondent guy that Hamas is not only not destroyed, it's going to recover its strength, and it's still the unchallenged ruler inside Gaza. Then he says the Israeli public will be surprised when it finds out what the person who says he wishes to be remembered as Israel's defender, in other words, Netanyahu, had to concede during the negotiations. It's not just control of the Philadelphia route, but also the Netzarim corridor, including the ability to genuinely monitor the return of over 1 million Palestinian civilians to northern Gaza. He also agreed to allow the entry of 600 trucks with humanitarian aid per day, 100 more than the daily average before the war. And then It says, during the months in which he rejected the plan, which had already been proposed last May by the Biden administration, Netanyahu is mainly worried about his radical right-wing allies, Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, who threatened to dismantle his coalition. It now appears that Trump left him with no other choice. We'll talk about that. And then there's this sentence, which I just loved. Some of the prime minister's blind followers are going through a painful sobering up these days. Trump is not an admirer of Israel or Netanyahu. So... So this is, of course, all counterintuitive, because we were told for months that, you know, however genocidal the Democrats are, Donald Trump is going to be even more genocidal, whatever that could possibly mean, given the hell that people in Gaza have gone through and are still going through. So I guess I want to talk about why Trump would be doing this.
I think that part about Hamas being in a position to control civilian affairs in the Gaza Strip now is so key, because how long did we hear for the past 15, 16 months, how many Western politicians did we hear saying, even Bernie Sanders said something along these lines, that Bernie Sanders said, oh, you know, you can't have a ceasefire with Hamas in place in the Gaza Strip. You know, all these European politicians saying that Hamas can play no part in the future of the Gaza Strip and so on and so forth. In the texts of the leaked texts of the agreements that are going around that have been distributed about the ceasefire text that has been discussed in Doha, there's no mention of that. There's no mention of Hamas ending civilian rule. So it's very clear they're going to be still in place again.
And there's nothing, of course, about Hamas disarming in the agreement. But of course, Asa, you can't have a ceasefire without Hamas in place, because who's going to implement it? Who's going to organize the return of your hostages and so on? I just want to remind people what Netanyahu said in Congress in June when he got, 57 standing ovations. He said that the war in Gaza could end tomorrow if Hamas surrenders, disarms, and returns all the hostages. But if they don't, Israel will fight until we destroy Hamas's military capabilities and its rule in Gaza and bring all our hostages home. That's what total victory means, and we will settle for nothing less. That's what Netanyahu said. So by his own standard, this is a complete defeat for Israel. Now, let's talk about why Trump would put pressure on Israel and what that means and how Trump did it. And I guess the first thing I want to do is remind people is that on, I think it was January 7th, Trump posted this video of Columbia University professor Jeffrey Sachs on his Truth Social website. And let's actually watch the clip, Tamara. It's a short video, but this is what Donald Trump, the incoming president of the United States, posted on his social media account.
Area, and you may actually hear from grown-up reporters who are lying through their teeth or ignorant beyond imagining that, oh, the war in Syria, yes, Russia intervened in Syria. Well, do you know that that Obama tasked the CIA to overthrow the Syrian government starting 4 years before Russia intervened? What kind of nonsense is that? And how many times did the New York Times report on Operation Timber Sycamore, which was the presidential order to the CIA to overthrow Bashar al-Assad, 3 times in 10 years. This is not democracy. This is a game. And it's a game of narrative. Why did the U.S. invade Iraq in 2003? Well, first of all, it was completely phony pretenses. It wasn't, oh, we were so wrong, they didn't have weapons of mass destruction. They actually did focus groups in the fall of 2002 to find out what would sell that war to the American people. Abe Schulsky, if you want to know the name of the PR genius. They did focus groups on the war. They wanted the war. Where did that war come from? You know what? It's quite surprising. That war came from Netanyahu, actually. You know that? It's weird. And the way it is that Netanyahu had from 1995 onward the theory that the only way we're going to get rid of Hamas and Hezbollah is by toppling the governments that support them. That's Iraq, Syria, and Iran. And the guy's nothing if not obsessive. And he's still trying to get us, gotten us into endless wars. And because of the power of all of this in the U.S. politics, he's gotten his way. But that war was totally phony. So what is this democracy versus dictatorship? Come on. These are not even.
So that was posted by the incoming president of the United States. That's incredible. Incredible, if you think about it. And Netanyahu said nothing about it, not positive, not negative. But that video, the fact that Trump posted it, caused shockwaves and fear in Israel. Because what this does is it sends a clear message that don't count on unconditional support from the United States. Don't think we're going to fight your wars. Now, does that mean I think that Donald Trump is definitely not going to do something stupid like attack Iran? No, that's not what I think. But I think it creates enough uncertainty about his position that if you're Netanyahu, you can't confidently count on Donald Trump to back you up 100%. And in a sense, that's the genius of Donald Trump, is that he leaves us all guessing. We don't know exactly what he's going to do. And therefore, there's a lot of power in that. So when he sent his advisor, Steve Witkoff, his envoy, to arm twist Netanyahu and tell him, you're going to do this deal. And some more reporting came out today from Axios that said that Steve Witkoff went over and told Netanyahu, after saying, I don't care about your Shabbat, get over to your office. And Netanyahu, like a good boy, came down to his office on Shabbat, just like he was told to do. But Witkoff apparently told him that Donald Trump is serious about this deal. Don't mess it up, which means that Trump and his people know that for the past year, Netanyahu is the one who has been sabotaging these deals. And I want to get into the why I think Trump might be doing this more in a moment, but I think it's very important to say at this point that we said right at the beginning of this genocide that it could be stopped with one phone call from the president of the United States. And this is essentially that one phone call that proves that that was always the case, and that this act that the Democrats put on, that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and Tony Blinken and Linda Thomas-Greenfield and the other blood-soaked war criminals put on, that, oh, we're working tirelessly for a ceasefire and that we just have to convince the Israelis to come along, was always BS. They could have stopped this.
And that Hamas was the one holding up the negotiations over and over and over again. We heard Tony Blinken say, we're waiting, you know, the ball is in Hamas's court. They refuse to come to the negotiations table. It's, you know, or their demands are preposterous and ridiculous. And, and as we said at the time during those, you know, during those instances, that this was complete BS, that it was Israel always refusing to do the right thing, that it was Israel and the U.S. ensuring that this genocide, that this Holocaust could be continuously perpetrated without any repercussions, or without any justifications, completely in flagrant violation of every single humanitarian international law on the books, and that Israel could again do what it wants because the U.S. lets it. We actually have a clip. Maybe this is a good time to go to that clip of our friend Max Blumenthal challenging Tony Blinken at the U.S. Yeah. State Department today.
It's good a time as any.
Yeah.
A fantastic clip.
And Sam Husseini, our friend, the reporter Sam Husseini, yeah, also did the same thing.
100 reporters in Gaza were on the receiving end of your bombs. Why did you keep the bombs flowing when we had a deal in May? We all knew we had a deal. Everyone in this room knows we had a deal, Tony, and you kept the bombs flowing. Why did you sacrifice the rules-based order on the mantle of your commitment to Zionism? Why did you allow my friends to be massacred? Why did you allow my friends' homes in Gaza to be destroyed when we had a deal in May? You helped destroy our religion, Judaism, by associating it with fascism. You waved the white flag before Netanyahu.
To take questions at the end.
You waved the white flag before Israeli fascism.
We'll have the time to take questions
your
at the end.
Your father-in-law was an Israel lobbyist. Your grandfather was an Israel lobbyist. Are you compromised by Israel? Why did you allow the Holocaust of our time to happen? How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? You too, Matt. You smirk through the whole thing every day. You smirk through a genocide.
Thank you.
Oh. You're pontificate about a free press. Sir, you pontificate about a free press. You're hurting me. You're hurting me. You're hurting me. I'm asking questions after being told by Matt Miller that he will not answer my questions until I'm asking questions. Wasn't the point of the May 31st statement to block the ICJ orders? You blocked the ICJ orders.
Please, sir, respect the process.
Respect the process. Respect the process. While everybody from Amnesty International, to the ICJ is saying that Israel is doing genocide and extermination, and you're telling me to respect the process. Criminal, why aren't you in the Hague? Why aren't...
Sam Husseini. The first one was Max Blumenthal. The second was Sam Husseini. Now, imagine if that was at the Kremlin. And all those American journalists, all those obedient scribes of the legacy pro-government media would be screaming about press freedom in Russia and look how they treat journalists in Russia. They all sat there in silence as their colleagues were being dragged out for challenging a literal genocide. It's so disgusting, but it's so satisfying to see Antony Blinken and these other war criminals challenged to their faces like this. And they're asking the right questions, the questions that nobody else in the so-called Washington press corps bothers to ask or dares to ask is, there was a deal in May. Why did you pretend that Hamas was the ones blocking it? Everyone knows that's a lie. Genocide was their choice. Genocide was their policy. And they used the cover of negotiations, as Asa called it, a ceasefire process, as a cover for their genocide. And they planted fake stories in the American media, which the New York Times and the Washington Post dutifully ran, about how angry Joe Biden was with Netanyahu in private. And he was calling him, using bad words against him. Utterly disgusting. And they are now exposed by Donald Trump, who picked up the phone or sent his envoy over and said, you're going to stop this now. You're going to sign the deal that you refused for the better part of a year. And Netanyahu said, yes, sir, I'm going to do it. And all the reporting in the Israeli media, we've had these last minute glitches yesterday and again today, and now the cabinet is delaying the vote. The Israeli media see right through it. They're saying, oh, this is all Netanyahu acting out to the end to pretend that he is in control and that he is fighting for every last concession, whereas the reality is he is not going to dare defy Donald Trump. Now, The question is, why is Trump doing this? I've had lots of people saying to me, Ali, that, you know, there's no, Trump has no sympathy for the Palestinian people. I don't assume he does. He's never really expressed any sympathy for Palestinians. He hasn't in his statement since the ceasefire deal has announced. But what do we know about Donald Trump that's consistent? And I discussed this in the article that Tamara just put up that we published the other day, is that Trump has expressed, as we saw with the Jeffrey Sachs video he shared, this impulse against the endless wars, not because he has great sympathy for the targets of U.S. imperial wars, but because he sees these wars as draining the United States and costing the United States. In his first term, he was a complete failure at stopping any of these wars. And in fact, he contributed to the situation now by, among other things, ordering the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani in Iran, and of course, supporting Israel to the hilt, which is why this is now so surprising. But what is consistent about Trump is that he doesn't seem to have to put any value on so-called US allies. He doesn't care about NATO, he's hostile to NATO, and he's hardened that position. In his first term, he was saying, they have to reimburse us and pay up 2% of their GDP. He's raised that to 5% now. He's saying NATO countries have to pay the US 5% of their GDP, basically, or increase their defense spending, which would all go to US military industrial companies anyway, mostly. And he doesn't care about Germany, which is supposedly the bedrock of the transatlantic relationship. And he doesn't care about Canada, the largest US trading partner with the longest land border between any two countries. And he's saying we'll cut off the trade with Canada. We don't need their cars, we don't need their lumber. He's insulting Justin Trudeau as the governor of Canada, in other words, as if it's already the 51st American state. So my point, that's what's consistent about his worldview, is that he doesn't put any value in these relationships that he doesn't think directly benefit the United States. So if that's the case, the question I would ask is, why would he care about Israel, which is a tiny country, a massive drain on the United States? According to Jeffrey Sachs, and in a video shared by Donald Trump, is dragging the United States into these wars that have cost literally trillions, have cost the United States literally trillions. And Israel, he looks at that and he says, well, we've sent them $25 billion just since October 7th. And
they can't
Joe
win.
Biden wants, sorry?
And they can't win.
And they can't win. And Donald Trump, there's one thing he hates is a loser. He likes winners. You know, right. That's the type of guy he is. And Joe Biden wants to give Israel another $8 billion on the way out. So that's why I'm not so surprised by this. And his approach is, well, if we're paying your bills and there's no one's bills is that the United States is paying more than Israel's, then you do what we say. And the implication of this also is it shatters the myth that the Israel lobby drives things. Trump may be a singular figure in a sense that he has the political clout to do this. And I think one indicator is, I looked at this, take the most fanatical pro-Israel person you can find in the United States Senate, someone like Lindsey Graham. There is, I mean, you can't find anyone more fanatically anti-Palestinian and genocidal than Lindsey Graham. If this deal had been the same deal had been imposed on Israel by Joe Biden back last year, Lindsey Graham would have been screaming bloody murder. He would have been saying, We have forced our ally Israel, who we love more than life itself, to surrender to Hamas and to surrender to terrorists. And it's a disgrace that Joe Biden has done this. Well, guess what? Lindsey Graham loves this deal. And he's only mad that the Democrats are trying to steal credit from Donald Trump for this deal. So to me, that's a significant indicator that the politics around Israel are capable of changing surprisingly quickly. Now, does that mean that I think everything is going to be rosy, that Donald Trump is going to be a great ally of the Palestinian people, that he's not going to take measures that are incredibly harmful to Palestinians? None of that. But for the moment, this is where I think things are, and things are contested and contestable. And it is not a given anymore that the United States is just going to be in lockstep with Israel, especially after this catastrophic last 15 months, which, even if you disregard the suffering of the Palestinian people, have done nothing for the United States, nothing for its influence in the world, nothing for its hegemony, nothing for its economy. Nothing good has come out of it, even from a purely American nationalistic perspective.
I think that's the key point, really, is that this is contestable. And if there's one thing that you can say about Donald Trump, is that he has, I mean, unlike Antony Blinken, who's clearly a fanatical Zionist, and unlike the sort of desiccated husk of whatever's left of Joe Biden's brain, who Donald Trump doesn't have an ideology, doesn't seem to have an ideological commitment to Zionism. You know, as you were saying, he likes winners, and Israel is increasingly starting to look like a loser. And it's you've talked about this, Ali, you talk about this in that article. There's this shift we've seen really in the last year or two on the right in the United States, where there is no longer complete lockstep unity in favor of Israel like there used to be. There is increasingly more voices on the right in America who are more skeptical of Israel. And in a way, I suppose that's kind of similar process to what happened in the US, in the Democrats over, you know, a far longer period. These things are contestable, absolutely.
Yeah, and then one sort of last point I want to make on this is, people are saying, oh, well, yes, but Trump wants to, you know, he wants the Gaza thing to stop because he wants to push forward with normalization, with restoring the Abraham Accords and so on. In fact, he says that himself in a post on Truth Social that he put up after the ceasefire deal was announced. And he said, with this deal in place, my national security team, through the efforts of the special envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, will continue to work closely with Israel and our allies to make sure Gaza never again becomes a terrorist safe haven. We will continue promoting peace through strength throughout the region as we build up the momentum of the ceasefire to further expand the historic Abraham Accords, referring to the agreements that normalized Israel's ties with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Morocco. And of course, the big prize here, supposedly, is Saudi Arabia. And there have been, you know, murmurings and rumblings that that's what he wants to do. And what I want to say about this is all of that may well be his intention. There's nothing in there that sounds great for Palestinians. He doesn't talk about Palestinian self-determination or even a Palestinian state. He doesn't mention it at all. So this is not an ally in that sense. But the point is, America's plans don't necessarily go to plan. What is it that the resistance fighters say? They plan and Allah plans, and Allah is the best of plans. They plan and God plans, and God is the best of planners. Well, we can paraphrase that a bit, that America plans, but America isn't always the best of planners. My point is that the Abraham Accords were already in place when Trump was president last time, and that didn't stop October 7th. That didn't kill the Palestinian cause as they hoped and intended it would do. And just adding Saudi Arabia to the list, a country that has done nothing for the cause of liberating Palestine, and formalizing a relationship with Israel that it's already had, really doesn't change the equation. So that may be their intention, but what the last 15 months have proved is that no scheme, no group of collaborators, no set of Arab tyrants posing for photo ops with Benjamin Netanyahu, none of that will make the central question of Palestine disappear. And the option, you know, Israel, this was the thing that hung over everyone, that Israel could go in and just, they believed they could do it. They believed they could go in and destroy Gaza and topple Hamas. And they went in and they certainly committed a genocide, but they didn't topple Hamas. They didn't destroy the resistance. And the resistance still has its weapons. And this is crucial because a deal like this doesn't depend on trusting Donald Trump or Benjamin Netanyahu. It's why the resistance insisted on structuring it in phases so that they have leverage at every step if Israel decides to renege on the deal, which is a very high possibility because that's what Israel does. And even if we get through all three phases and then Israel decides to reinvade Gaza or whatever it is, the resistance still have their weapons. And so that's where we are. I just want to say all that because really this is an achievement of the resistance, and that achievement has even changed and affected politics within the United States. And we should not approach this as everything is a foregone conclusion, everything is an American secret plan that is going to be rolled out just as Donald Trump wants. That's not the way things work. It's not Donald Trump and the United States who make history and write history. It is the people of the region who write their own history.
Yeah, and like you've been saying for a long time, Ali, they don't have magic bombs, you know? They've bombed Gaza to smithereens, and yet the people are still there. The fighters are still there, and they're still carrying on. That figure that John mentioned earlier, I found so striking, of the 5% dud rate of the Israeli bombs. How, you know, and John saying that it's enough for two generations of munitions. You know, we know that the Palestinian fighters have these homemade munitions. We've seen it all in so much detail documented by John. It's not over, like, to say the least. It's not over.
No, and it's clear
they're the seeders of their own downfall.
That's right. And it's clear that the Palestinian resistance in that tiny little strip of land, you know, what is it, 5 miles by 3 miles at its widest, has completely changed the world. You know, this is a major irreversible shift, not just in the dynamics of power in that region, but the impact that the Palestinian resistance has had on U.S. politics, on U.S., you know, on the consciousness of people around the world, and especially in the Western countries. And you know, we are remarkably lucky to be able to witness that kind of change. And
That was the Electronic Intifada with Ali Abu Nima, Noura Burrows Friedman, and John Elmer and Essa. And just to let you know, one last note is that we have been sharing Electronic Intifada content since the beginning of this genocide. And whatever was reported by John Elmer today was predicted basically 15 months ago by John Elmer, that this will be the case, that they will not be able to erase Palestinian resistance, that at the end there will be a victory parade, despite the brutality, despite the massacres, despite the Holocaust that they've been subjected to. Thank you for listening, and we'll be talking more about this issue next week on Wednesday, and we'll update you on what's happening. At 2 p.m. every week, we'll be there to report on Gaza.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. According to CNN, thousands of additional active duty U.S. troops are being ordered to the southern U.S. border with Mexico just 2 days after President Donald Trump mandated that the U.S. military step up its presence there, according to officials familiar with the matter. There are already roughly 2,200 active duty troops at the border to help support U.S. Customs and Border Protection's work there. An official familiar with the order told CNN even more active duty troops are expected to be deployed to the border in the coming weeks and months. It is not clear whether the troops will be armed, but none of the active duty troops are currently authorized to perform any kind of law enforcement role under a century-old law known as Posse Comitatus. President Trump did say in an executive order Monday, however, that he will decide within 90 days whether to invoke the Insurrection Act at the U.S.-Mexico border, which would allow him to use active duty troops domestically for law enforcement. In related news, immigration authorities can now enter schools, healthcare facilities, and places of worship to conduct arrests, according to a new policy from the Department of Homeland Security. The move, announced yesterday, reverses guidance that for over a decade has restricted Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection from carrying out immigration enforcement in sensitive locations. The ICE guidance dates back to 2011. Customs and Border Protection issued similar guidance in 2013. The announcement had been expected as Trump works to deliver on his campaign promise to carry out mass deportations of undocumented residents. Advocates argue that raising the prospect of deportation at schools, churches, or hospitals can prevent migrants from getting medical attention or allowing their children to attend school. In more news about the new administration, Donald Trump has ordered all federal diversity, equity, and inclusion employees to be placed on paid leave starting at 5 p.m. today, according to a new memo from the Office of Personnel Management. The memo also asks federal agencies to submit a written plan by January 31st for dismissing the employees. The moves follow an executive order Trump signed on his first day, which ordered the sweeping dismantling of the federal government's diversity and inclusion programs. This could include everything from anti-bias training to funding for minority farmers and homeowners. In other news, a historic amount of snow is burying parts of the U.S. Gulf Coast after the region was struck yesterday by a once-in-a-generation winter storm. At least 9 people are believed to have died due to the dangerous conditions gripping the South, officials said. States of emergency are active in Louisiana, Georgia, Alabama, Florida, and Mississippi. Many schools and airports across the southern states are closed as travel has become difficult to impossible in some areas. Tens of thousands are without power, and major disruptions are expected along the Gulf Coast for days to come due to a lack of snowplows and other cold weather equipment. More than 25 million people are under winter weather alerts from Florida to Florida.